Hello and welcome to Beautiful Minds, a journey into the minds of creative people and what makes them tick. This show is brought to you by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. Opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and or opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. The goal of this program is to offer insight into the beautiful and creative minds of all types of artistic people right here in the New England area. I'm your host, Tom Hurley, and coincidentally, I'm also the guest this week. Several people have asked me if I would in fact be the interviewee for a change, and so I employed the help of my good friend Roger LaValle to be the interviewer. So without further ado, here's me. Are we recording now?
We are recording now.
I'm going to stay back here away from the microphone a little bit. So, okay. So that I'm not right up on it. Get down on it. Get down on it. So,
if I have an opening line and a place to start, then I'm pretty good at going from there. But I don't know where to start.
Where at the beginning is usually a good place to start.
So, Tom.
Yes, Roger.
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay. About 15.3 billion years ago. You want to go that far back?
No.
Okay.
Like maybe 80, 90 years?
Okay. Yeah, we can do that. I'll have to probably Google some of that. I wasn't around 80 or 90 years.
There wasn't Google back then either.
No. This is true.
All right. So let's talk about where you came from and what your childhood was like and what led you to follow, you know, the passions that you have. You know, you're a musician, you're a painter, and you know,
that's
you're
right,
a wrestler.
A wrestler?
Wrestler. Not a rustler. Wrestler. The wrestler is now Juicy Seafood, and we don't talk about that place.
No, I always wanted to be a cattle rustler, though, I think.
No, you didn't.
No, I didn't. It's fun to, when I mishear things, I like to jump on that.
I used to know a girl named Miss Here. She was my Latin teacher in high school.
Are you sure it was Monsieur, your French teacher?
No. Yeah. That was Miss Chagnon.
Ah, oui, oui.
Oui, oui.
Or as they like to say in France, way. Oui. It's more of a yeah than a yes.
Really?
Yeah, true. Oui. Way. Way. Way, way, dude.
Wow, that's unexpected.
I know.
So let's talk about your background of what got you sort of... what brought things together for you to become the person that you are now creatively and, you know, the things that you've been passionate about and interested in doing, and especially music.
Okay. Yeah, I'll try to be serious for at least a moment.
No, don't. Don't bother.
Well, I think music for me has been a part of my life probably for longer than I can even remember. And this is sort of funny because I was going to call my sister Patricia last night and just play over the phone what apparently was the very, very first song that I ever wrote.
No kidding.
Yes. And
would she want to hear it? Did she know about the song?
She knows about it, yeah. I don't remember writing this song because I was maybe 3 or 4 years old, and I was in the backyard, and we had this sort of screened in porch on the back of the house, and Trisha must have been up, you know, above me, and I was playing around the clothesline in the backyard. And for reasons still unknown, I just was walking around and just repeating, "Come on, fish. Hey, fish. Come on, fish." But there was like a rhythm to it.
Yeah.
And she just, I don't know, it was just something about her telling me that makes me laugh, obviously.
You don't remember it at all.
I don't remember
it. She could be making it up herself, but...
Yeah, no, she definitely was, and it's a fond memory for her. But I guess the point is that it probably wasn't very very long after that that I was singing, like, yeah, you know, singing melodies and hearing them on the radio and being able to mimic them before I could really even read or write or anything right. like that.
It's interesting that, that's not the first time that I've heard somebody say that even like before they were verbal and could mm-hmm. talk,
yeah.
they were singing.
And, yeah.
It's interesting how deeply you connect, one connects with music, you know, at the youngest age, your mother singing to you or,
right.
or, you know, whatever cartoons or whatever it is that has music, like that's a, one of the first things that I think you resonate with.
I believe that probably most human beings are kind of, that's kind of baked in. But I have also heard that, like I've heard that young children have perfect pitch, for instance, but they soon lose it. I've heard of people that have perfect pitch, if they don't use it as an adult, it goes away, sort of a phenomenon. So when I was still quite young, about four or five, my sister Eileen brought me to St. Charles Borromeo Church, which was over on June Street, to sing in the choir.
No kidding.
Again, not a really deep memory for me, but I do remember it, and I just loved singing. You know, it was just, I liked doing it. So, but I didn't really ever have any formal training or music lessons or anything like that, like a lot of us haven't. You know, so when I got a little bit older, still, I should mention that I'll be 58 in November, so I was growing up in a household with seven older brothers and sisters, and so there was a lot of music from the 1960s right. and the 1970s going on.
Really, like, pivotal time in pop
yeah.
music, for sure.
That was going on when my dad wasn't around to play cowboy songs. Mm-hmm. What's the, I should know this because I heard them so many times, like the Clancy Brothers and there's another famous. The Chieftains and music like that, Irish folk music, Irish drinking songs, and truck driver music, which is its very own specific thing, as I'm sure you know. W.C. McCall with Convoy, he did another song called Wolf Creek Pass, which I still know all the words to it and know the melody, and I was very fortunate back in 97 to travel across the country, myself and my dog Murray, and we drove over Wolf Creek Pass.
No kidding.
In the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. So that was fun to do that. And so...
That Murray's idea?
It was, yeah. Yeah, Murray did most of the driving, in fact. He was a German Shepherd, and I had a Mercedes-Benz, and so he insisted on... No, it wasn't a Mercedes. It was a Jeep. But Murray was a very good driver.
He was a good driver, yeah.
Yeah, he was sort of like Toonces.
The
cat who could drive a car.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But see, I went off the rails there a little bit, trying to give you like a chronological thing here.
But you had a rich... childhood, rich with music and surrounded by music coming from different places in your life, in your family. And what, so that sort of primed you, but what gave you this sort of drive to be like, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start a band and I'm going to write songs.
Yeah. So like I was saying before I rudely interrupted myself, I had this rich environment of music around me. It was very diverse. there was Anne Murray, there was, like I said, there was Irish folk music and country music, and there was Cat Stevens and Bob Seger. And then as I got a little bit older, in the late 70s, early 80s, there was Foreigner and bands like that.
What essentially we call classic rock.
Yeah.
Which was
the Eagles. I remember the Eagles. So, you know, in my origin story of where did I want to become a musician, I think the Eagles are very important, and here's why. I think it was like 76, Hotel California came out. And I was just fascinated with the, not just the songs on the record, but the record itself.
Right.
Like the picture on the front with the hotel. There's like a little, like a dome building. It's sort of all dark, but there's a neon sign. And then on the back, or I think it was on the back or on the inside, the whole band was sort of in this hotel lobby.
Yeah.
But which I didn't even understand at the time where they were. And it was kind of a creepy photo. I don't know if I'm sure a lot of people remember it, but, you know, so I'm looking at all of this and I'm listening to the music. And the only song that the lyrics were included, because they were printed on the record sleeve, was Hotel California. All the rest of the lyrics.
Otherwise, we would have never known what Kalidas was.
Yes. The warm smell of Kalidas.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was infatuated with this song. And my friend across the street, John Lynch, his brother Billy, his older brother, had a drum set in his basement, so we would hang around in there, and it was sort of like that Step Brothers movie where, you know, did you touch my drum set? You know, the right drumstick was out of place. So Billy would, you know, there was absolutely no touching Billy's drum set.
Right.
Yeah, okay. The minute he was gone, we were like all over this thing. So we started to form a band. I'm doing air quotes. Mm-hmm. No one played any instruments.
Of course.
Everyone wanted to play the drum set. But we took it on the road. And at grammar school, myself and this kid, Matt Ceretti, and Tommy Ouellette, and Jeff Cadenice, we formed the Red Barons. And we
the innocence of these.
I know, and we would play our rulers, were the guitars, and Matt had two rulers, and he would play on the on the tabletop. And I remember I was the singer, and the only song we knew was Hotel California.
With so, the extended guitar solo on the
You
need a yardstick for the solo.
And so the kids, the other band members would make the guitar noises, you know, bow, 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 like this, you know, and I would sing.
Yeah.
And I do remember this. I remember, like, because we would do it when the teacher wasn't around or whatever. And then she encouraged us to perform it in the classroom for all the kids.
Which is a big deal.
Oh, it was our debut as you know, the Red Barons.
You're giving me the opportunity to be a rock star in front of my peers.
And I remember asking her, though, of course, this is 1977, and in the song, he says, "This must be heaven, or this could be heaven, or this could be hell."
And you couldn't say that.
And
cool.
I went up to Ms. Sullivan and I said,
"You're a polite boy," and you asked for
permission. I said, the man says this word, hell. And she said, "It's okay. That's called poetic license."
Oh, boy.
"And you're allowed to say it because it's written there, and you don't want to change the lyric."
Wow. That's a progressive teacher.
And she was not. She was not. But in this regard, she was. So got to do that.
Did you even do the Mercedes-Benz?
Oh, we did it all. Yeah, we did every bit. Even the guitar solo, believe me. The kids are, you know, it was hysterical. So that was sort of, that was like the beginning, right? So then in the following couple of years, I'll tell a real quick story, because I was sort of a husky kid at 9 and 10 years old. I was already like 5 foot 5'2 or something and like 80, 90 pounds. You know, I wasn't overweight, but I was like a big kid. And I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but my voice started to change. And I had a pretty deep voice for a little kid, and certainly for singing. And we were singing for the Christmas pageant. Now, this is the same teacher that encouraged me to sing in the band. And suddenly, you know, we're practicing for the Christmas pageant, and I'm singing in key and with pitch and everything, but
everyone else is up here.
Everyone up
down
is
here.
Way up here, like the Peanuts gang, and yeah. I'm like down here, like ring lows, you know, yeah. And
blue rolls over here.
Yeah. And she said to me, "You're not allowed to sing."
She shut you down.
She shut me down. And I was devastated wow. by this. And I told my mother. And my mother said to me, because Ms. Sullivan said, just mouth the words. I was heartbroken. I was like, I want to sing this, you know. And my mother said, obey your teacher, mouth the words, and then on the day of the performance, you sing out as loud as you right. goddamn well want. And I was like, yeah.
Your whole career has been basically to show Mrs. Sullivan.
Yeah, it has been, yes. Yeah. It's yep. So that happened. And then I think it was 79 or 80, the kids are all right came out.
Right.
The Who.
And it was the height of, you know, the height of Who-dom. Keith Moon had just died, and
yep.
they were at the absolute pinnacle of their career. And you know what's going to happen now?
Yeah,
that comes out.
So that comes out. Of course, I didn't realize it was a soundtrack to the movie, but it's a double album compilation album,
as greatest hits as
greatest
it gets.
Hits sort of yeah, but yeah. with live tracks and yeah. stuff like that. So. I remember this, too. I'm going to just go back for one second. My older brothers and sisters used to sing, Tommy, can you hear me?
To you.
Yeah. And then they would just simply repeat, Tommy, 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 like on the record. Yeah. It drove me crazy. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
They were teasing me, and I would scream and stop it, you know. And they would, of course, they would do it even more. And so then here I am. I put my sister Cecilia's, because it was her record. She got it for Christmas from my brother Frank, and I stole it from her. Once I heard it, I'm like, this is mine now. And wasn't Tommy, Can You Hear Me on the record? And
right.
This very first time I ever heard it.
You're like, oh.
And I'm like, wait a moment. And so, but that was it. Once I heard The Who,
it all came together.
That was it. I'm like, I got to do this. I have to do this. And I became such a massive fan of the band. Roger Daltrey, Pete Townsend.
The other guys.
The other guys, yeah.
Rabbit.
Yes, Rabbit Bundrick. And yeah. So now I'm begging my mother for a guitar. We were very poor. We were not well-to-do people. And my diabetes is calling. Hang on.
Unknown caller. It's Wilfred Brimley.
So I'm begging my mom for a guitar. We didn't have any money. They had a Harmony acoustic, Sunburst acoustic guitar at Service Merchandise in Auburn. Please, 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 can I have this? We don't have the money. You don't know how to play the guitar. I said, well,
How do you learn?
How do you learn if you don't have a guitar? You know, she's like, just stick with the tennis racket, kid. You'll be fine. So I begged her and I begged her and I begged her. And she saved money for close to a year.
Wow.
And the guitar was only $29 or $39. It was not, you know, by any standard.
That's a lot of money, you know, when...
When you're broke and you're on food stamps and
it's a frivolous purchase.
Yep. And my parents were divorced at the time, and there was not a lot of money to be had. And so anyway, I finally end up getting the guitar. And it came in a cardboard box, mm-hmm. like a little kind of a pie-shaped box. Brought it home. Inside was the Mel Bay songbook, and it had Skip to My Lou and, you know, songs like that.
Yeah.
And I
That's
ran
how
up.
We all start. We all start with Mel Bay.
Yep. Ran upstairs, learned Skip to My Lou within a half an hour, came running down the stairs. My dad was there, and he was, you know, like, what'd you spend this money for? And I came down the stairs and I played this song, and he was like, what just happened? You know? And that was it. After that, it was such a hard guitar to play. Oh my God. The action was like 6 inches. It was brutal.
Beginner guitars are the biggest torture.
Yeah.
I don't know if people know that, but when you get a beginner guitar, it's deliberately the worst playing guitar ever.
Yeah, and it's sort of should be the other way around almost,
right? Think.
You know, but here's the thing: nice guitars are expensive, and you're not going to buy a $2,000 Taylor for your 12-year-old. And
but you don't know anybody. You don't even know that there is a difference, or that you could get, you know, softer strings or whatever it is. Like,
right.
You don't know because you're a beginner and somebody's buying you a guitar. They're doing their best.
Yeah.
And it's like so sad to think about how many people just give up because it hurts to play.
It hurts to play. But, well, interestingly enough, it hurts to play, right? So Who Are You comes out and there's a song called Guitar and Pen on that record. And in it, Townsend is singing, or Daltrey singing, Townsend wrote it. And my fingers are bleeding and my knuckles are white. And you can be sure you can open the door. You can open the door tonight if you've got something to write. Right. So, and, you know, right there, and my fingers are bleeding. Yeah. And I'm like, why are your fingers? And I'm like, oh, I know why your fingers are bleeding. Of course, I think he might have meant his right hand, because he was always doing windmills and ripping fingernails off and stuff. But I immediately was like, well, apparently there's some pain that you have to travel through to get good at this. Yeah. So I just stuck with it as long as I could. And
eventually you gave up.
Yes. I was able to basically borrow and then absolutely never return ever again. Sorry, Brian Robichaud. My friend's brother's Tisco Del Rey electric guitar.
Nice.
And this little cheap solid-state amplifier. And it had, I remember it had flat-wound strings on it.
Oh, wow.
And it was easier to play.
Right.
And I just stuck with that. And before too long, I don't know that I was a sophomore in high school. I think I was a sophomore, and I was hanging out in the summertime with some friends, and they formed a air quote band in this guy Bob Fletcher's backyard, and they were desperately trying to get through an Aerosmith song, "Get Yourself a Cooler and Lay Yourself."
Yeah, right. Same old song. Now.
Yeah, and this guy Bob. Love him to death. Great kid. He was the singer. He couldn't carry a tune in a wheelbarrow. So I didn't have any interest necessarily in like joining the band or whatever, you know. But I was like, hey, let me try.
I can do this.
So I got up and I sang the song, and in like real time, they fired Bob. But the problem was we were in his backyard. So we were very quickly.
They all look at Bob. I'm like, Bob, you see what's happening here, right?
Yeah.
You get it, right?
he very quickly was like, you guys can all get the hell out of my yard now.
Yeah, right.
So another friend of ours, Jeff Barbin, who lived right up the street, he didn't want anything to do with the band other than to host us in his garage. So We carried all the equipment, this massive trainer, PA system, and you know, all of it. And we went up to Jeff's garage, and we formed Dirty Water. And everyone,
Red,
of course,
Red Barons to Dirty Water,
right?
Nice.
And you know, the funny thing was is that, like most people learning to play music, they want to play their favorite bands and learn other, you know, cover songs, I suppose. And I was never good at that. So sort of by necessity, I just started to write my own songs. That way I wasn't sort of caged in by, well, I don't know how to play that chord yet or whatever, you know. So I was able to sort of, that was my workaround. And I was improving all the time as a guitar player. But I'm writing songs, like real, not come on, fish, but I'm writing like songs with melodies and parts and everything. And I do remember the quote-unquote first song I wrote was called In Your Dreams, and it was very generic and basic. But it was original. I didn't copy it from anywhere or anything like that. And I wanted to play my songs.
Right.
So in the band, we were playing covers and we were playing my songs. And we played the high school dance and we played the variety show and all those sorts of things. And so all through high school, I'm getting better at this. I accidentally discover how to multi-track on a double cassette deck boombox. So I'm layering tracks, and we talked about this before, but I know other people are listening, I think. And so it just kind of blossomed, and then
your whole identity, your who you are, sort of came into focus, like all the things that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't a bad student in high school, but I wasn't great either. Like I really did want to go to Syracuse University and study film and television production and that sort of thing. But my grades just weren't there to do that. I could have gotten them there. I went to community college, and but even then all I wanted to do was play in a band, you know. And I, in fact, before I was out of high school, I joined another band called On the Run, and these kids were all older, and I think the drinking age was still only 18, I think. So we would play at like the Golden Lion and Auburn and places like this, and almost immediately I'm playing in like restaurants and
you're
clubs.
Gigging.
I'm gigging,
like local gigs,
making a couple bucks here and there, you know. So that was exciting, and so you know, it just kept evolving, and I think a lot of people thought it would be a phase. Like I think my parents thought, you know, okay, once you get out of high school, you're not going to be in a band anymore.
Nobody else seems to see a future in being a musician.
Well, that's because there isn't one.
It's true. Like it's just going to be heartbreak and failure.
Yeah.
I'll do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like that sounds like me. So, around 92, I formed Joe Rockhead, and this was originally going to be just a recording project. My friend and longtime bass player Brian Hill, who was a brilliant musician in his own right, ended up going to Yale, studying classical piano and composition and that sort of thing. He saw the potential in my songs that even I didn't see, and he was an integral part in the beginning of shaping those songs, much in the same way that you help me now with, let's push this over the edge a little bit. Let's add a strange chord here or do something a little different. You know, he understood those things. I understood them in my ears, but theoretically I didn't understand like how to get there, you know.
It's like he was like a catalyst to to translate what you were hearing in your head into,
yeah,
you know, a sound.
Yeah, he definitely was, and he was very critical, but that was okay. I appreciated it because I trusted his ears, you know,
right,
and his sensibilities, and he understood what I wanted, and so it was a good combination for me. So we started the band. His friend, who became my friend, drummer Chuck Schleicher, joined in, and we all agreed we're just going to record on my 8-track Fostex recorder, and that'll be it. But of course, I was like, we gotta play at least once, you know.
Yeah.
So by now, I've already gone through the police academy, and I'm a police officer. Maybe a year or so when the band forms.
You're pretty young still. You're 25.
I was 22, going on 23.
Okay.
Yep. And so when the band formed, actually, I'm sorry, this is before the band formed, I was laid off. I had been working at Wyman Gordon, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is an airplane parts factory in Grafton. Very, very gritty, grimy job. I felt super trapped there. I thought, I'm going to die here, you know. It was awful. And I remember the day I walked into that place for the very first time, I thought, I have to find a way to get out of this place.
Yeah.
But the thing was, you would get laid off all the time. And then they'd hire you back, or you'd get, you know, you'd have a particular position. Like my highest position was a crane operator, which was very high paying job, difficult to do and everything. But I'd get bumped down to different lesser jobs and then kicked out the door and called back and all this. So I'm laid off. I'm broke. I'm living on my own at this point. Oodles and oodles and you know. I remember I used to walk like a mile and a half to the Thai Cha Da on Park Ave just to get a quart of sticky white rice.
Yep.
And they would give you little containers of peanut sauce for free. And it was like 75 cents. That's all I could afford.
That sounds so good right now.
Oh, I would walk down there and get that and walk home, and yeah, I'd just eat the rice, and that would be my dinner. So I'm living on Fruit Street in this little studio apartment. And I would watch Dialing for Dollars, which was, anyone who doesn't know, is a TV show. And they would show a movie, I think. And
yeah,
then the host would come on and tell you when to call. And you'd call in and win money or something,
right,
like that. So that was one of the things I did a lot, and I watched the Flintstones twice a day. It was on in the morning, it was on in the afternoon. So we decide Joe Rockhead is going to perform one time. And
that's Joe Rockhead is a Flintstones reference.
Yes, yes. And so this is how the band got its name. There was a an open mic, and it was at the Above Club, which was
coincidentally above the
Thai Cha Da. But it was an open mic. So anyone who doesn't understand how those work, there's a sort of a lottery system. In this particular system, it was first come, first serve,
right,
or something like that. But you were allowed to play three songs, 15 minutes, and then you had to give the stage up to the next person, you know. So we get there, we lug an entire drum kit up the stairs,
wow,
a bass rig. I had this 600-pound twin reverb Fender amp.
Oh my God.
And I had to bring more than one guitar, you know.
Yeah, for three songs.
Yeah, so we get up there, and I'm filling out the form, and I see it's like Roger LaValle, Jimmy Jones, Duncan Arsenal. You know, it's like all just individual people and their names, you know. And I thought, well, we don't have, I don't want to say Tom Hurley because we're a band.
Right.
You know, and, I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. We can be, we'll be Joe Rockhead. And I always loved the idea of the Joe Rockhead character because I, in the history of the Flintstone cartoon, you only ever see him once. Other than that, he's only referenced right. by either Fred or Barney. And he's famously known for being the chief of the volunteer fire department in Bedrock, which I think is hysterical because everything's made of stone.
Right.
And so clearly that was just a place where the boys would go and play yeah. cards, or they went bowling or whatever Fred and Barney did each week. So we became Joe Rockhead, and that was it. They just
so it was the chance, like the chance decision, because you had to put something on the list.
Had to.
Joe Rockhead it yep. was.
Yep. And that and it stuck, and it was fun too, because well, few years later, I wrote a song called, just simply called it Joe, and in it, I reference how everyone calls me Joe.
Right,
even
right.
though I would tell them, my name's not Joe, it's Tom.
It was you know? Never even your nickname, it was...
Right, but now, like to this day, my brother, Mike, when he sees me, he's like, Joe Rock! You know?
Yeah.
It's my license plate. Like, yeah. It's, you know, that's just basically my... sort of alter ego, I guess.
Right.
So, yeah, so then the band took off. A lot of people came that night, I think, to see us play. And immediately everyone was like, you got to do that again. You got to, you know, do you got to do a whole gig. You got to do like a 45-minute set, you know. And so we did. We started playing my original songs and, of course, covers, and we became sort of this hybrid cover original band, and we had tremendous amount of success. The band lasted until 2006. Different members went through it.
92 to 2006?
Yeah. We released four full-length CDs, which are now streaming on Apple and iTunes, Spotify and YouTube and
all the streaming services.
All the streaming services carried your Rockhead. Yeah, so that's sort of that's how that all kind of went on, and then of course in between all of that, you and I became good friends over time and performed together in the Heavy Horses, and now
yeah, there was a time where the local Worcester area music scene was really, and there was a time where we were trying to make things really inclusive and put these sort of showcase bands together to show people like really how talented the people around here are. Like it's really, from my point of view, it's incredible the amount of true talent that there is around here, whether anyone notices or not, it's here. So the things like doing the Heavy Horses and the Green Street Music Series shows was a real high point for me and for the local music scene here in Worcester, where it really did showcase and it formed a lot of really good relationships.
Yeah.
People that probably wouldn't, you know, Joe Rockhead played mostly at a different club than my band did.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the chances of like we'd meet each other at a music store, but we wouldn't really like really connect until we started doing these shows like the
right.
Green Street Music Series, and this would be the mid 2000s, and I think that was really a pivotal time for so many of us in mm-hmm. in the local music scene, and it was so supportive. And to have people like really acknowledge your existence, let alone that wow,
yeah.
you can sing, you're really good, or whatever. And
yeah, I was very humbled and honored, and it did a lot to humble me to be invited to do some of those shows, and then certainly to be featured in the Who tribute, and then Greg Monroe, who he was the guy,
he produced all those shows,
and he came up with the idea. Well, I think it was born out of the AM Gold.
Well, the
series.
Heavy Horses,
yeah,
the Green Street Music series was sort of an idea born out of Greg Monroe and Duncan Arsenault, who's another legendary Worcester musician who's in my band, The Curtain Society. They were sitting around talking, and they said, let's put on a show to showcase all the great singers and musicians, and we'll do like a show to commemorate the Stones playing at Sir Morgan's Cove in 1981. And the ulterior motive was always to showcase the musicians and the talent around here. And so his role in producing these shows was, the production values were crazy. The rehearsals were, you know, they were great musicians to begin with, but we rehearsed like crazy, so we couldn't get it wrong. And, you know, we put a lot of work into making the show feel like a concert.
Yeah, we definitely did. I loved it. It was, like I said, it was just a great experience.
Yeah, it was incredible. But the Heavy Horses band, which was, instead of being one band, the series started with the Stones, and then the Beatles, and then the Who, and then the Police and the Clash on one night. Like, we picked bands, and then pretty soon it became a theme. And the first theme might have been AM Gold, and it was all, you know, 70s music. And then Heavy Horses was the name given to the FM classic rock band.
Whoops.
FM classic rock band that was not your typical, because there are classic rock bands, cover bands are a dime a dozen, but like to have a band of that caliber that would pull off really complex songs and just kill it, kick it out of the park, was really impressive. So Heavy Horses, with three different lead singers, plus me and John Donovan on guitar singing, so you'd have five singers doing these complex showstoppers. You know, Kansas and Journey and REO Speedwagon, like these big vocal songs. And we weren't doing it because it was a cover band that we wanted to do. We were like, we loved being on that stage and hearing ourselves. Wow, this sounds incredible.
Yeah, you know, you hear, you know, the weak link in anything, right? There weren't any weak links in that band. Everyone was great. You know, we had Eddie Barnett playing the drums. We had Ron Momini on the bass.
Mike Warren on keys. And Craig Rodding and Don Sweet and you on vocals.
Yeah.
Me and John, I don't know if you said.
Yeah.
It was the most fun crew of people to hang around with. So it was not the desire to be in this band. It was the desire to have an excuse to play this music with our friends.
Right. It's the only band that I was ever in where I don't ever remember having a disagreement with one of the other musicians for any reason. I know that we've talked about this before too, that the music scene, at least from my perspective, back when all of this started, everything that you've just been talking about, it felt very competitive. And it was, to a certain degree. Everyone's competing for a stage to be on every Friday and Saturday night, and there's only so many, and a fan base, and, you know, all that sort of thing. And so for a long time, I was never petty, but I was envious, you know, jealous of other bands' successes, where I felt like we should be succeeding in that way.
Maybe to the point where, did you have more in hindsight? Do you feel like you might have had more success than you gave yourself credit for?
Yeah, I think so. But it didn't, you know, it didn't feel that way then, you know. But once I got involved with the Green Street series and AM Gold and then the Heavy Horses, it opened me up both emotionally and mentally to where I understood that it is not a competition at all. It's about making the best music you can make.
Right.
So in order to do that, you need to align yourself with the best
for sure
musicians.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, the best people.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather play with the best people than the best musicians.
Yeah, they're not always the same, one and the same.
Right.
But it takes a lot. It takes the chemistry of musicians that you're playing with. It takes, you know, the love for the music that you're playing, mm-hmm. and the talent and skill to pull it off, but to also perform it well.
Yeah.
You could sit there and be a virtuoso, but you are not an engaging performer, or you're not engaging with the rest of the band. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's all those elements have to be part of it to make something really great.
Yep. I agree completely. I that's why I loved it so much. And I made so many new friends, and I became more gracious and generous towards other people and definitely other musicians. I've told you this, I always felt like if anyone was the weakest link, it was me.
We all have imposter syndrome, every one of us.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think that's a good place to start, strangely enough. Because if you feel that way, I mean, obviously there's some part of you that knows, like, I belong here, you know, but there's enough of you still saying, do I though? You know, but
that's what always keeps you pushing yourself.
Exactly. If you want to stay there,
yeah.
or if you want to get into that next room, you've got to keep pushing yourself.
Right.
You've got to always say, I can be better than I was last night. I got to be better than this. And that's one of the big things I got out of those relationships. And I also began to learn, like you said, so many other musicians have imposter syndrome. They feel as though they don't belong there. They're not good enough, you know. They feel like they're the weak link, and you look at them and go, you're crazy. Like, you're so much better than me or this guy or that guy, you know.
And but, I think that's kind of an interesting place to be with a group of musicians where you might all be battling those kind of feelings, and you're all aware of it, so you can support each other and be like, acknowledge each other in an honest way, like, man, that was great, that was amazing. And they believe you because you're not just blowing smoke.
Yeah.
It's really nice. And it's not.
Unless you're having a cigarette and then you're.
Yeah, then they are blowing smoke, which is gross. But it's not always about what you think success means. Success means different things all throughout different points of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a musician, sometimes success is just playing a song that just works or is exciting and makes you feel good. And like, you look around at the end of the song at the musicians you just played with, and you're like, wow, we just pulled off a heist.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
And there's nobody else in the room, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
It's really a special thing. Yeah. And we're lucky.
Absolutely is. I just posted on Facebook. I just played a gig on Saturday out at Lilac Hedge, and there was a woman that I knew from high school there. And some of her friends that I also knew, and they were yelling out to me like, "Play some Joe Rockhead music," you know. And then I heard someone yell out "Lonely," which is a song on the second Joe Rockhead album, and so I played it. And she came up after I was done, and she was like in tears.
Wow.
And she said, "You like," and I'm thinking it was that bad, huh?
Did you get stung by a bee? Is something wrong?
No, but she said, you just have no idea what that song means to me.
Wow. A song that you created out of nothing.
Yeah. And so thank you for playing it. And, of course, playing it without the band is much different. There was that. I think it had more of an intimate feel to it.
Right.
And, you know, so there was a lot of components going on there. And I got a little choked up because as much as it meant for her, it meant so much to me to hear that.
Right.
Because I make music and I put it out into the world and I don't really know if anyone is listening to it. And if someone is listening to it, I don't really know who that might be, you know.
Right.
I don't know if it's having that effect.
There's no way to quantify what, you know. It's not like you're on the Billboard charts in a way where you can like actually see in a finite way of what it is. But then to find out that something that you did a while ago affected somebody enough that they remember it and it means something to them.
Yeah.
It's really kind of an incredible thing. It's a great feeling.
Yeah. In fact, I went up and thanked her after I was finished, and I said, you know, I had no idea. You know, I said, do you stream it? Or, you know, she said, oh, no, I have all the CDs in my car, you know, and
wow.
I still listen to them. And I thought, well, you must have an old car because it's like a CD player. No, I can't.
I have all your 8 tracks.
Yeah, but no, it was really nice to have someone say that to me.
It's a really validating moment, and it's not everybody gets that. Not everybody is going to be Madonna and the Who, and you know, David Bowie or Prince.
Mm-hmm.
There's millions.
Or Bob the Cobbler.
Or Bob the Cobbler.
Right.
Cobbler Bob.
Cobbler Bob.
A mad deus. Anyway, so you don't really... There's millions, if not, you know, thousands and thousands of musicians out there that kind of do it because they love it and they put their music out into the ether.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know if it's going to connect with somebody. And then when you find out that it does, it's really, it rings a bell in your soul. It's really a big deal.
You've been listening to Beautiful Minds, a journey into the minds of creative people and what makes them tick. I hope you enjoyed part one of a 2-part interview with yours truly, your host, Tom Hurley. I want to thank Roger LaValle once again for volunteering to be the interviewer. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Please remember, we'd love to hear from you. Are there any local musicians or artists that you'd like to hear about? Call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback. You can reach us at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. And as always, I'd like to tell everyone that I'm grateful for the universe and for whatever put us all here. I'm grateful for all of the gifts that it's given me, and I'm truly grateful for you being here with me today. Have a great day, and thanks for listening.
Medical Myths and Facts with Dr. Richard Curtis.
We all live with some degree of uncertainty, but there are moments in life, during economic upheaval, political tension, illness, or global crises, when uncertainty seems to dominate everything. And when that happens, stress levels rise almost automatically. There is a biological reason for this. The human brain is built to detect threats. Deep in the brain sits a structure called the amygdala, which acts like an alarm system. When something uncertain or potentially dangerous appears, that alarm activates the body's stress response, raising heart rate, increasing cortisol, sharpening attention. In short bursts, that system protects us. But when uncertainty stretches on for weeks or months, the alarm can stay partially activated. People begin to experience chronic worry, difficulty sleeping, irritability, and trouble concentrating. The key question becomes, how do we live well when the future is unclear? Psychologists and neuroscientists generally point to a few practical strategies. The first is learning to distinguish what we can control from what we cannot. Much of our stress comes from trying to mentally solve problems that are actually beyond our reach. The ancient philosophy of Stoicism emphasized this idea thousands of years ago. Focus your energy on your own actions and your own judgments, not on events outside your power. When we redirect attention toward what we can influence, our work, our relationships, our daily habits, we regain a sense of agency, which reduces stress dramatically. A second strategy involves protecting our mental environment. In today's world, uncertainty often arrives through constant streams of alarming and disquieting information. News updates, social media, and commentary can create the impression that danger is everywhere and continuous. The brain, however, interprets repeated exposure to threatening information as repeated danger signals. Limiting news intake to specific times of the day and avoiding constant scrolling helps prevent the stress system from remaining perpetually activated. The third strategy uses the body to calm the mind. Stress is not only psychological, it is physiological. Fortunately, the nervous system has a built-in calming mechanism known as the parasympathetic response. One of the simplest ways to activate it is through slow breathing. Inhale slowly for about 4 seconds, then exhale for 6 seconds. That longer exhale signals the nervous system to slow the heart rate and reduce stress hormones. Physical activity works in a similar way. Even a brisk 20-minute walk can significantly lower cortisol and improve mood. A fourth protective factor is routine. Uncertainty disrupts predictability, and the brain thrives on predictable structure. Maintaining consistent sleep times, meals, exercise, work patterns, all create islands of stability in an otherwise unstable environment. Finally, one of the most powerful buffers against stress is human connection. Talking with trusted friends or family members helps regulate emotions in ways the brain cannot easily accomplish, and certainly alone. Social connection literally dampens stress signals in the nervous system. So the lesson from psychology and neuroscience is reassuring. We cannot eliminate uncertainty from life, but we can manage how our minds and bodies respond to it. By focusing on what we can control, limiting constant threat signals, calming the body, maintaining routines, and staying connected with others, we give the brain the conditions it needs to remain steady, even when the world feels unpredictable. And that steadiness, more than certainty itself, is what ultimately allows us to navigate difficult times well.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.